for the rest of us, we're going to spend our morning in many ways revolved around these passages that we've just heard. And we'll read them again, or we'll hear them again a little bit later. But I want to start somewhere else. So at a certain age, elementary school kids start taking standardized tests, and many of you are probably familiar with these tests. Well, earlier this week, Rebecca's test scores came in, and I pulled them up online, and I started reading through them, and then I called Jane over to see them, and we started talking about, she doesn't even know, she was out of town this week, about what her test scores might mean for her and for her future and for school and for all of these things. And this conversation about what her standardized tests meant had me thinking about the fact that we live in a culture that is absolutely obsessed with achievement. What have we done? What have we accomplished? What have we achieved? What have we produced? These are the things that are celebrated and honored and valued and maybe above everything else. And we start this early, don't we? We ask our kids from early ages what they want to be when they grow up. And this question is never about the kind of person that they want to be. It's always about what they're going to do when they get older, right? Their future career, what they're going to make money doing and support us when we are ready to live with them. And it doesn't stop there. As these kids grow up and they get ready to graduate high school, we can't stop asking them what they're going to do next. I'm sure Maria has heard this question a few times. I know I've asked her, like, what's next for her? And the bummer is that these graduates know that culturally, there are some answers that are better than others. There's this Christian comedian. His name's Michael Jr., who does this pretty hilarious bit. I'm not going to do it like him because he's a comedian and I'm not. But he asks people, he says that there's a big difference in the responses you get when you ask them about where they go to college. And he points out that if you ask somebody who goes to a four-year school where they go, they give you a nice, clear answer: UCLA, Davis, East Bay, San Jose State. But then Michael Jr. asks, have you ever asked somebody who goes to a community college where they go to school? You get a much longer answer. Well, right now I'm taking classes at LOSPO while my financial aid comes in, and there's this one class that I need, and you know, I'm going to transfer as soon as my credits get approved, and so on. Right, people know that culturally, community college isn't as respected as other options, and so they feel the need to explain themselves and justify why they aren't going to a four-year school yet. And it can sometimes feel worse for people who pursue trades or other sorts of professions. But college isn't where it ends for us. As college students then get ready to graduate, we need to know what they are going to do with their 16 years plus years of education. Are they going to do something worthy? Are they going to use their degree? Are they going to make a difference in the world? Are they at least going to pay off their student loans? A couple of weeks ago, a guy named Chris texted me and asked if we could set up a phone call. Chris was in my youth group when I was in Kansas City. And as we talked on the phone, he was telling me about his brand new job at this think tank in Washington, D.C. And as we talked, I experienced this strange pride in what he was doing and what he had accomplished so far. And that this young guy who was busy making a name for himself in DC was still interested in what I thought about faith and politics. As I was preparing for this morning, this thought struck me. Chris is so much more than what he is doing. Duh, right? Like, I mean, I know that. Like, deep down, like, I truly care about Chris, about who he is. But in our conversation, I treated him as though the only interesting thing about him is what he is doing. We can be obsessed with what people can do, what they can accomplish, what they can achieve. Some have described our culture as a merit-based society, a society where your place, your value are entirely dependent on what you have achieved or have the potential to achieve. As a country, we have an economic system that values certain people and what they do over other people and what they do. As a country, we're busy debating right now whether we should establish an immigration system based on merit or what you can do. Every corner of our lives is touched by what we do or what we produce, achieve, or attain. Even our faith. Our faith that is first and foremost about the grace of God. Our faith that starts and stops with what God has done for us. Our faith, which is fixed on the completed work of Jesus, somehow twists and becomes principally about what we do. I've been having all sorts of interesting conversations since the week when I used John Wesley's sermon, The Almost Christian, in one of my sermons. That week, I talked about John Wesley and how Wesley makes a distinction between the almost Christian and the altogether Christian. And over again, I keep finding that people do not want to be identified with the altogether Christian. Now, nobody wants to be the almost Christian, but nobody can bring themselves to say that they might be the altogether Christian because we all have this deep sense that we are imperfect. Even though during that sermon, I especially, specifically said that the altogether Christian is imperfect. One of my favorite responses to that sermon was when someone told me a few weeks later that they were pissed at me for that sermon. Kind of joking, kind of not. Again, because they heard altogether Christian sort of through our cultural ears and assumed that this person, this altogether Christian, must be someone who does everything right, who is completely faithful in every instance. Otherwise, how could they possibly be an altogether Christian? But again, I made the point that morning that the almost Christian, that the almost Christian is the one who does everything right, who has the appearance of godliness, but that there is something missing that the altogether Christian has. And we'll come back to what the altogether Christian has, but I want to pause here just for a second because I think these conversations have been really important to reveal something about the way that our merit-based culture takes over and even controls our grace-based faith. See, our merit-based culture wants to celebrate what we can do and what we have done or what we will do. But our grace-based faith in Jesus Christ wants to make it clear that our identity, first and foremost, is a gift from God, and that our significance comes from God alone, and that God speaks over us who we are, and that is where life is found. To dig into this a little bit, I want to introduce you to the work of a couple men. Frank Lake was a psychologist, and Emil Brunner was a theologian. Together, these two men were working to figure out why there was such a high rate of burnout among missionaries working in this really hard region of India, and this was decades ago. Their project was really simple. What was it about these missionaries and the approach to their work that resulted in so many of these missionaries coming home, experiencing high numbers of quitting, becoming deeply cynical and bitter, experiencing what many call burnout? At the same time, these men weren't just studying these missionaries, they were also studying the life and the ministry of Jesus to see if there was anything that they might learn about his approach to ministry and why he doesn't show any of these signs or symptoms in his life. Well, as they studied these burnt out missionaries, they discovered a consistent pattern. Every single one of them could talk about God's grace. Every single one of them knew in their hearts that Jesus had died on the cross for sinners. They could talk about a time when they personally knew that they were loved by God. But it turns out this wasn't the starting point for their work. Every single one of them started their missionary work with some goal related to the fruit that they would bear in India. Some would set the number of converts that they would make. Others would put time limits on these goals so that they would reach this many people in 1 year, and this many in the second year, and this many in the third. Others would set the number of churches that they would start, or pastors that they were going to raise up, or towns that they would start a work in. Every single one of these missionaries was convinced that these goals had been given to them by God in their prayers. Because, of course, why would God send them to India if they weren't going to bear fruit? God had called me clearly. God is going to show me what it is I'm supposed to do there. It only makes sense that God would let me know what he was looking for from this work. And so here's the pattern that Lake and Bruner found. These missionaries, they started with a focus on their own fruitfulness in ministry. And if you're taking notes, we'll sort of see four movements here, and I'll highlight each one as it comes. But they started with a focus on their own fruitfulness in ministry, what they would achieve or attain. It wasn't just that they had goals for what they would achieve. But if you think about it, they had people who were supporting their work, people who were giving money so that they could go. There was a school that was sending them. They had their own personal sense of calling, and there were all of the failures that had gone before. This place was known for chewing up missionaries and spitting them out, and so there was this many were going one after the other. And so these missionaries were looking for a sense of significance in their success. And so significance is the next move that happens for them, so that bearing good fruit would bring them a sense of the significance that they were looking for in their lives. They would reach people where others had failed before. They would be successful missionaries. They'd make their families proud. Their donors would be glad that they had supported the work because there was something to show for it. Achieving, doing, accomplishing, bearing fruit, these all bring a sense of significance. And so then they would move to a place of sustenance. That's the third one. You develop habits and practices that help you sustain this sense of significance. You work harder to produce more fruit so that you can stay significant. These acts of sustenance include whatever you have to do to keep up appearances so that you feel significant, so that others see you as significant. But of course, this only works if you can bear the fruit that you set out to get. What happens when you're sent to a region in India where it's really long and slow work? What happens when you miss a number goal, or when it takes 3 years just to see one person come to faith, or when village after village kicks you out because of your message? What then? Who are you? Are you significant? See, all of this simply confirms that you've fallen short of significance, at least in all of the ways that you expected or others expected of you. In this case, your efforts at sustenance are really about bearing the fruit that will get you the significance that you have been after. All of this all of this, the effort to bear fruit, to achieve something, the significance that's tied to your accomplishments, the habits that sustain you in this drive, all of this is for the one thing that all of us, every single human being, longs for in our deepest places, even if we can't name it, a sense that we are loved. We are looking for acceptance. And that's the fourth one. Does God accept me? Will God love me if I fail in India? Fail at whatever it is I've set out to do? Does my family accept me? Will they love me if I have nothing to show for my time and my effort over these years? Do I accept myself? Can I love who I am if I am a failure? Frank Lake and Emil Brunner identified this pattern in every one of their burnt out missionaries. They started with a focus on their fruitfulness, tying their significance to their success, sustaining their pursuit with habits while looking for a deep sense of acceptance for having done something worthy or meaningful. Lake and Brunner call this the cycle of works. And they observed in missionary after missionary the ways this cycle crushes our soul and leads to missionary burnout. Others have observed, taking their work, how our merit-based society trains us to work out of this cycle so that we look at the fruit that we should be producing in our lives. We look at the things that we should be doing or accomplishing for God. We focus on the growth that our church should be experiencing. You hear should. These are all tied to specific longings for fruitfulness. And we live as though God can only be pleased if we accomplish certain things. If we are appropriately holy, if we are sufficiently loving. I want to suggest to you that the way we heard Wesley's distinction between the almost Christian and the altogether Christian shows that we may be more almost Christians than we want to admit. Not because we haven't done enough to be an altogether Christian, but because we are often too focused on what we've done. The altogether Christian walks in light of what God has done. Lake and Brunner discovered this pattern in these missionaries because while they were studying these missionaries, they were actually also studying the life of Jesus, the life and the ministry of Jesus. I said this earlier, and I want to show you what Lake, I keep wanting to combine their names, Lake and Brunner, not Luke and Brainer. Luke and Brunner. Lake and Brunner. Ugh. Okay. They noticed that all four gospels are clear. Before Jesus ever does anything in public, something critically important happens. Jesus travels down to the Jordan River where he is baptized by John. It is there where God announces Jesus' identity. This is my dearly loved son with whom I am well pleased. I think about that, right? Before a single teaching, before a single healing, before Jesus overcomes any sort of temptation in the wilderness, God speaks a word of love, of affirmation, of acceptance over Jesus. Paul will later tell us in his letters that Jesus is the word of acceptance that God speaks over us before we ever did anything. This is where everything in Jesus' ministry starts. He knows that he is accepted. He knows that he is loved by his Father. But Jesus doesn't stop with a single experience with the Father in the river, but Jesus engages in practices and habits that sustain him in this truth. He doesn't pray so that he can bear fruit. He doesn't read scripture so that God will be pleased with him for having a quiet time. Jesus prays because he knows the love of his Father and he's excited. He draws near to seek his Father. And when Jesus prays, he's reminded of that love. When Jesus goes to the synagogue on the Sabbath, it's not because good Jews go to the synagogue. It's because he knows the Father's love and he knows that it's in the synagogue where he will hear the scriptures with his brothers and sisters and he will hear the testimony of God's faithful love throughout history. Jesus finds sustenance in habits and practices that remind him that God accepted him and calls him and sustains him. And it's here where Jesus is able to find his true significance. His significance comes from his relationship with the Father. He is God's son. The crowds call him a prophet. Others want to call him king or Messiah. But he doesn't receive these. For Jesus, the only thing that matters is what the Father says of him. And Jesus climbs a mountain with Peter, James, and John. We heard this read earlier. There, the Father appears and he speaks, "This is my dearly loved Son. Listen to him." It is this God-given significance that allows Jesus to bear fruit. It's important to point out that while he is able to heal and teach, sometimes he can't heal, and sometimes people cannot understand him. The fruit is ultimately out of his hands, but he knows this, and he knows that the real fruit of his life actually won't even come until he's dead. And so it does no good for him to seek after fruit that he might decide is important to produce. Jesus has zero interest in predicting the outcomes of his work. He leaves all of that to the work of the Holy Spirit. He simply embraces the identity given to him by his Father. And he remains close to the truth. And he submits his life to his Father as a son who knows that he is dearly loved. Hopefully this little look at the life and the ministry of Jesus gives you enough to see what Lake and Bruner saw. They saw a way of living with God that begins with grace, a way of living with God that overflows with grace, a way of living with God that ends with grace, a way of living with God that is all grace. They noticed this pattern in Jesus, and they called it, because they were really clever in their naming, the cycle of grace. And it was only after they saw this cycle of grace lived out in Jesus that they were able to see what was going wrong with so many of their missionaries. They noticed that Jesus lived his life receiving God's grace, knowing he was accepted by his Father, letting God bring whatever fruit may come from his life. But the missionaries lived backward. And so the missionaries lived backward. They lived their life in pursuit of God's acceptance, trying to bear enough fruit, trying to do enough good to gain God's approval. Friends, this morning, I just want to remind you that grace is the only path where life is found. But we live in a culture that is so completely obsessed with what we do that it's harder than I think we realize to resist the pull that what we do is what matters most. But can we hear this morning? Can we hear that we were made by a God who accepts us before we ever do anything? This is grace. That we were made by a God who loves us before we ever loved him back. This is grace. That we were made by a God who sent his son to die for us while we were still his enemies. This is grace. We were made by a God who adopts us as his children, calls us sons and daughters before we ever get to work in the family business. This is grace. Everything is grace. Alex and Allie, call you guys out especially, because in many ways, this message is for the two of you this morning. We get to join with God in sending you to Colombia to serve as missionaries. And the temptation exists for you to go focusing on the fruit that you will produce. But let us encourage you to remember who you are. Before you ever decided to go, God was at work in your lives preparing you to go. Preparing you for this moment. It has all been grace. You are dearly loved by God. Right now, before you go, before you learn a new language, before you do any work in Colombia, your Father in heaven is pleased with you. And he calls you his own. So may you go in grace. But I don't want to give the impression that this message is for only Alex and Allie. It is for each of us. With our final words this morning, Katie will send us out of here. Send us into our homes, into neighborhoods where we live. She will send us out as missionaries. And it's essential that we know the depths of God's love for us. Brothers and sisters, you are loved by God. You have been accepted. God thought you were worth his love and the death of his only son. This is why we come to the table every single week. Because knowing that we are accepted, it is the bread. It is the cup, it is the story that reminds us, that nourishes us, that sustains us again and again, that God is for us, that we cannot seek his acceptance because it has already been given. He has already given it. Amen.